You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. I have two guests for episode 67, Mark Jackson and Jeffrey Casey, who are the band Rhema. The song that you're hearing right now is called 21st Century. Back when the band was a six-piece, released on the soundtrack to the 1984 film Voyage of the Rock Aliens, a Pia Zadora vehicle that actually featured most of the band in acting roles. So that's when they had their record deal. The band broke up not that long after that, but Mark and Jeffrey continue to work together in ways they'll describe. And finally now, inspired by their work back in the day, have released a brand new album, Shine, under this band name Rhema. We're going to talk about two songs from that new album, Rebel Flame and The World Is So Small. Then we're going to look back to one of their old songs from that same 80s era, Combine Man, although this is a 2009 remix that Mark Jackson did. And finally, we'll listen to another song from the new album called Life in Front of You. For more information, visit RhemaBand.com. For more information about this podcast, check out NakedlyExaminedMusic.com. And if you enjoy what we're doing, please consider supporting our efforts at Patreon.com/NakedlyExaminedMusic. So I will have played, at your request, you said that the thing that people would be most likely to have heard would be 21st Century that was featured in the Voyage of the Rock Aliens film. However, on reading more about that, I see that that's Greg Bond singing, that Craig Jensen wrote most of that, and that Dennis Alexander, your producer, did most of the backing tracks. Do you guys even play on that song?
Yeah.
Okay.
We do play on the song, and I sing on it, too. I'm not the lead singer but on that one. But
I want to get to the new album quickly, but let's sort of get the preliminaries out of the way. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you two have even done together, right, in between the 80s and now. Say a little about what that has entailed and why you're branding this new thing as Rhema, even though it's only two of you out of the six. We're going to go in this interview with your marketing, but explain a little. And actually, first, introduce yourselves individually. Mark, you go first just so the listeners can get your voices here.
I'm Mark Jackson. I am the lead singer for Rhema and co-producer and co-writer with Jeffrey Casey.
Yeah, I'm Jeffrey Casey, and I am Mark's co-writer. And in Rhema, I was the drummer, but I also do a lot of the keyboard stuff. And Mark and I tend to be multi-instrumentalists.
Are there actual real drums on either the 80s stuff or this new album? It has a very Depeche Mode kind of setup in terms of a lot of keyboard work that I can hear, maybe some guitar and singing. What is the actual setup here?
Define real drums. No, I'm
What is that?
No, it was played, all the drums that you heard were played on keyboards in some way. And it's pretty intentional. I mean, we started out as a techno band and techno back in the 80s, it was kind of new wave, techno pop. And we coming out of the kind of the post-punk thing. So that's kind of where everything was going. And when Jeffrey and I started to work together, we started a song together. We were going to start a new project with a new name and stuff like that. But we just thought, why don't we just kind of pick up where we left off and have some fun with the sound that we had gotten going? So we just sort of like, okay, well, if you have all this technology now and you have all this access, what would that sound like now? So that's kind of where we took it. And we did keep it on the techie side. There's some real guitars and stuff like that in there, but a lot of it's computer music.
And I'll say, to respond to your question about what was it like back when Rhema was on MCA and, you know, we were up and coming techno rock stars, which there really weren't many of that came out of that era. We really were an acoustic band. We were a real band that actually played our instruments and we had real drums. And it was part of our production deal that the producer decided to help us get a record deal. He was going to turn us into more of a synthetic Thomas Dolby thing. That wasn't our concept. That was his concept. We thought we'd go into the studio and record like we've always recorded with live drums. He decided he'd take a couple of Junos with a couple of the keyboard players in the band and the drums would all be synthetic. Which, although at the time when you believe you're so important in the music industry and you get, as a drummer, you get kicked out of the band, so to speak. At the time, it seemed like it was a bit of an affront. He didn't end up with that sound getting us signed to MCA Records, which is how we got connected to the movie. But for me as a drummer, I can tell you that I had to reproduce the sounds on the record when we would perform live. And it actually made me a better drummer. So for me, it was an experience where I learned a lot about my instrument and my craft from an experience where I basically was taken out of the creative process as a drummer. I still was involved on the songwriting end, but in retrospect, it really wasn't such a terrible thing for me to have gone through that.
All right, so we'll get back to the 80s and what you've been doing between then and now.
with our third song. And after that, maybe let's get right to the new stuff. So tell a little about the new album, Shine, and about the song we're going to hear first, Rebel Flame. Just a short intro, and then we'll play it, and then we'll talk more about it.
Okay. So Rebel Flame is a result of Mark and I, we took a hiatus from one another after being a songwriting team after Rhema. And as Mark said, we decided we'd get back together and start writing because we wanted to do a project. And the project then became, let's just kick off Rhema again, but it'll just be you and I, because in Rhema, you and I were two of the songwriters and Mark was really the driving force. So when we relaunched Rhema, we decided we wanted to try and capture the people that knew us back then and keep the sound true to who we were, because as a result of this film we were in, we had a bit of a cult following primarily throughout Europe. And this song, believe it or not, was started because I heard the theme to the BBC World Services on the radio one day. And I started singing a melody over that synth line. It was written by a guy by the name of David Lloyd, a composer. So I went home and I recreated that exact synth line and then by accident put an effect on it, and it became the basis that I put the track together for Rebel Flame.
So that's what you're talking about?
Yeah, it actually was a very synthetic, synthy, robotic line that you hear before BBC World Services. I played the exact notes from that World Services theme, but when I put the effect on it, it created this very bizarre groove. And I sent it to Mark, and Mark went, yeah, this is something. And the lyrics are obviously very, very timely, which we can talk about after they hear the song. But that's where the song came from. I sent a track to Mark, and then Mark, being the genius that he is, just ran with it, and it became a monster.
Mark, do you have any introductory words about the lyrics before they hear it, or whatever you did?
We didn't really set out to be known as political at all, but it just seemed the kind of thing where the politics of Trump and all that just permeated all the conversations. And so it was almost impossible that we could avoid not writing about it. So we tried to get inspired basically by what we saw going on. And then at the same time, by the time we'd finish a verse or something, the song started to already get outdated because there's so much happening in the White House on a daily basis that it was hard to stay current with it. But it was cathartic, obviously, to be able to say some things that we felt needed to be said.
But the lyrical choice we decided to make was we were not going to make it so specific. We were going to make it more word pictures about an insane ruler. And that way it would encompass whatever happens in the coming years. So that's why it's a bit of a word picture, but it's very specific who we're talking about.
With the rebels' flame.
So, snakes to the poor.
That was Mark's line. He changed one of my lines to say that. I liked it.
So there's a nice lyric version with lyrics video of this that I'll link people to that they, if you want to hear specifically what's being said, especially when we get to the bridge, it's almost a rap section that we have in both these first two songs. You have this thing that, you know, you speed up the output of the words to quite a bit faster than the rest of the song. And the second song we're going to hear, there's a version that, in the lyrics that Jeffrey sent to me, was actually said chant for the bridge.
I think that's the clinical word for it.
Do you want to say something about the way that you put these things together? I mean, even just the amount of intro that you've got three different layers that it doesn't just, you know, have the light part and then the big dance drums. It's like three different layers. I'm using the album version that folks have just heard does not have Trump talking over that whole intro, but that's, you got an alternate audio and the video that they can look at actually has various things that he's saying over that. It makes me feel a little cleaner to not have that on the recording.
Well, he's so articulate. So,
well, the thing about the songwriting is that, you know, we don't mention him. And certainly this can apply to a number of scenarios, but we do make some very specific references about, you know, him being insane or whatnot. But, and it's pretty topical, but at the same time, we try to keep it at least relatable on a wider scale. So you don't have to necessarily go there. And also, we want it to last a little longer than the shelf life of this president. So, in terms of putting stuff together, and it's kind of difficult to not talk about production along with songwriting, because when you've got all these elements and you're kind of building it as you go, then the track a lot of times is telling you kind of what to do with the melody or what to do, how the lyric is going to flow or what the mood is for that lyric to lay in. And so a lot of that has to do with the bed you make for the song to kind of sleep in. And so my challenge is always don't layer too many things on there. And I've sort of embraced it. I tend to have too many parts going on. So I try to trim the backs to where there's some definition and you kind of hear it. But I've always admired producers who are more minimalistic than I am. And I'll get there. But if it feels good, just go with it. I used to sit around a long time and just lament over how hot the snare is and how the kick and the bass, you know, are not overwhelming each other and all that stuff. And now I don't really do that so much anymore. I found that you just do it a while and before you know it, you're getting those levels right and you're getting the tones right over time and you just get better at it. That's always good because then the technology doesn't get in the way of the inspiration. And that's always the balance, especially in pop, the balance between art and craft. How much of your soul are you still allowed to have in this track after all the technologies is kind of heaped on it? So it's tricky.
I'll say, first of all, one of the challenges we have with our current administration is how much of our soul will we all have left when all is said and done. However, as it relates to Mark's question about the intro and the fact that it's got so many things going on, Mark Jackson is heavily involved in film and TV, especially on the sync side. And I, to a lesser degree, am involved in that. And the one thing that I've learned from watching how Mark works is when he puts his hat on as a supervisor, if he's getting a request for a song for, let's say, for a trailer, and the publishing companies will send what they think works for the brief that's been sent out, which a brief is basically a layout of what they're looking for. I've watched Mark, because he's such a good musician, he'll blow through 30 or 40 tracks because he'll listen to the intro, the first verse to hear the voice, and the chorus and be done. And sometimes within the first 10 to 20 seconds, he knows whether it's going to work or not. That being said, what I notice in Mark's production is he just has a sense that when a song hits, it draws you in artistically, aurally, even visually before the lyrics hit. And I think that's why on a song like Rebel Flame, it's a very dynamic intro to the song. And you're either going to be repelled or you're going to be sucked into this world. The frame's being made for this picture, which is going to be the melody and the lyrics. And the frame is how the beginning of a song makes a listener react. And I think Mark is very cognizant and great at that. And yeah, sometimes it's too big, but Rame is a big world.
It's like Sting said, it's got to burn from bar one.
One of the issues when you're working in a purely electronic environment, I suppose this, I don't know why it seems more of an issue for me in an electronic environment than otherwise, other than in a live band, each instrumental sort of has his spot that they're supposed to fit into. But when you're layering synth tracks and you can just add or subtract as many things as you want, even in this intro, what is percussion is not quite percussion. It's not a drum machine thing. It's this not quite tuned sound that doesn't have the full, I'm sure it has pitch to it, but that you're not, it's a percussive timbre, so you don't hear it. So how you're getting that to match with the what I'm interpreting is that's synth guitar, or that's not actual guitar. The shung shung, you know, that's right at the beginning. That's over top that percussive stuff.
Yeah, that's not real guitar. Okay. I think real guitar comes in later.
So how are you getting patches that for sure fit together, I guess is my question. Is it a matter of these are tools that you often work with and you already know, or are you, you know, for every single thing, searching through 90 different potential sounds that you could then manipulate?
It's kind of a little bit of that, but it's not. It's like there's a limit to you have all these tools and you can just like stack and stack and stack. I don't do that because it's just, I think a lot of it's luck. Like I just start going through sounds. I go, oh, I wonder what this would be like. And I pull it in, and sometimes it's in the wrong key or it's too fast or too slow and I manipulate it. So I take a sound or an idea or something, and I'll change the pitch so that it fits the same key of the song, or I'll take a portion of that clip and then move it around and create a new pattern with it. It's just stuff like that. It's a lot of cutting and pasting, like you would in a Word document or something, in a way.
I don't like the word luck. I like the word instinct.
Okay.
Because on this track, I actually sent Mark a relatively fully formed work of music with some melody and a lot of lyrical ideas. But my initial track was actually kind of sort of what you're describing. It was kind of nice and everything sort of worked together, and I didn't do anything that was aurally odd, and I didn't have any weird percussion that sounded like it didn't belong, maybe like it fell off a tractor. And I gave that to Mark, and then he breathed this life into it. He made it this aural experience, which I wouldn't have done. And I think that's what you're referring to. You hear all these things and you're wondering, how did he make these sounds become this work of art?
The wall of sound that it is, yeah, as opposed to some distinct things that are scattered around.
He's from the Phil Ramone style of producing, for sure, only with plugins and an electronic environment. But yeah, I think Mark has an instinct. It feels like luck when it happens. And all three of us, we're all three songwriters, so we know sometimes something happens and you go, that was just lucky. Like, for instance, I told you that I played this from the intro to the BBC World Services on NPR. Well, it was probably luck that effect I put on it, but there probably was some rhythmic instinct I had that caused me to choose that. So I just, yeah, I'm trying to give us credit for having some decent musical instincts.
Now, when you're passing stuff to Mark, are you passing it as wave files or as data that he can then manipulate further? I guess MIDI or whatever.
Well, let me say this about that, because that's an interesting question. Back in the early days of Rhema, and you know, Mark and I have known each other now probably 35 years. So back in the early days of Rhema, we were again a band. And so as a band, you get together in a rehearsal space. You probably rehearse as much as you can. You fight. You disagree. You work out parts. You have interpersonal conflicts. But you spend so many waking hours with this band. And then the band goes on the road, and then now you're in this touring situation. The point is, a creative situation is a very intense situation. It's like Stuart Copeland said that it's marriage without sex. That's how he described the Police. It's so true. And in some bands, it's actually band with sex. But when Mark and I decided to put this back together and begin working, my feeling about this is, because we live in a world where you don't have to get into a room and see each other on a constant basis to create something, it's actually made this work. So Mark and I are on Messenger all day long, talking, chatting, talking about song ideas. And one of us will get an idea, and a message will come up. Hey, I got an idea. Mark will say, send it to me. Or he'll say, I've got something, I'm going to send it to you. And we'll send a mix of the idea. If Mark or I go, that sounds great, okay, let's work on it. So here's the big thing now. Rather than saying, we should get together and rehearse, Mark will say, this is the big word, send me the stems. So we don't get together anymore and rehearse. What I do is I output the data and I send it via Dropbox to Mark, who then brings it into his studio and he begins working.
But the one technical question, like, is the data, obviously, even if it's a sound file, it's still data. But that's different than a MIDI file or something that, like, I don't know what sound we should use for this, but this is what the rhythm should be. Or does that distinction even matter at this point? Like, I know there are plugins that even if you send a completed wave file of like a kick drum part or whatever, you could run it through something that could trigger a completely different sound that matches that exact rhythm of the kick drum that you recorded, but is a, you know, a totally different sound. So it doesn't even matter necessarily whether you're sending MIDI or you're sending wave files at this point. Tell me more about a little more detail about how you guys actually do this.
Say, for example, I get something from Jeffrey, he'll send me the stems to it, or he'll just send me a stereo mix of it, or whatever. And then I start to look at it from a more visceral way, right? I go, what does this feel like? Oh, it feels pretty good. It feels good. There's a good, I can connect to the feeling of the song, and already I got a melody that's starting to come, and I know that there's something to this. Then I'll take it and I'll sort of make a determination on whether what parts are rubbing wrong, or maybe what parts could maybe, you know, be fleshed out a little bit more, or, but also what's good that you don't want to lose, because obviously there's some vibe going on. So you can't just rewrite it. Really, you're smarter to just take it and go, okay, let's stay with the essence. And if we can improve some of the things sonically, and then just start working on the mix. And then as the song develops lyrically, it starts to come, and you go, you got something. And then you just don't, you just try not to break it. You know, you just try not to.
It's not MIDI data. In other words, if I send something to Mark, it's going to be actually wave files.
Sure.
Mark will either opt to take my wave files and use some of them and build around them, which he does a lot. But there have been times when I'll send him a wave file. It's not a MIDI file. I'll hear the song. I'll give him the tempo. And he might recreate the whole thing from scratch and leave and have nothing I sent him.
But it's still essentially the same thing.
So drums are your first instrument, Jeffrey? Is that right? Or that's just what you happen to play in that band at that time?
It was my first instrument, yes.
Okay. Do you write like a drummer? Do you think in terms of drums? Like a lot of times with these techno things, if the producer is responsible for the feel, then the specific electronic drum riffs might even come last. We've got the melody. We've got the basic structure of the song. Now, how are we exactly going to make it sound as big and awesome as possible? That's certainly one way. But as a drummer, often initiating these things, is that different for you? That you might actually, like Shriek Back is another band that I'm a fan of that I know actually starts rhythmically, like even when the keyboard is right, it starts with a groove. And that's then maybe, you know, the way Mark was just describing it is I get this thing and a melody starts coming to my head. So it sounds like you're starting with a groove with something like that first on this song, at least.
When you said that I write like a drummer, I've had many people say that very same thing. And it's true. I did some time writing in Nashville, and I oftentimes would write the hook to the song, and people would say, you know why the hook is good? It's because you kind of wrote it like a drummer. So it's very hooky and rhythmic. So yes, I do write like a drummer. It sometimes makes it challenging to write melodies for Mark, which I'm glad that he's great at melodies, because he'll redo my melodies so they sound like someone singing them that's not a drummer, but an actual singer. But the answer to your question is, in the electronic venue, as opposed to if I'm writing on acoustic guitar or writing in a section where I'm the drummer, it does not start with the drums. For Rebel Flame, as an example, again, this started because I heard this keyboard line. I recreated this keyboard loop. Now, you could construe a loop as being a rhythm, because it definitely was rhythmic, but I constructed that keyboard loop, and then I put an effect on it, and it created this rhythm, but it was not a drum part. I put the drum part on afterwards. For me, when I'm writing now, especially in the realm of Rhema, I try and create a vibe that tells me where the song needs to go. And oftentimes that vibe is not about the drum groove. It's a vibe. It could be a guitar loop. It could be a keyboard loop. And oftentimes it is a keyboard loop that'll inspire me then to create the rest of it. And I like to use a drum module that allows me to sort of create a drum track that sounds like a live drummer.
Let's get our second song on the table here, just since it's also from the current album and we can keep talking about your current way of doing things. So this is The World Is So Small.
We kind of picked this song as another song to play opposite Rebel Flame because it's a hopeful song. It was also inspired by current events in a way, but it's also the groove that Jeffrey came up with. This actual track had such a really evocative mood to it. I loved it. And I sort of took it under my wing and just said, I'm going to write this because I feel it. I feel what the song can be. And I kind of stuck with this idea that, you know, again, what Jeffrey was saying too is this, we like to write things that are visual. Like, you know, when you think about somebody literally embracing the earth and being able to put your arms around the earth, as it says in the hook, I respond as a fan of music really well to things that allow me to visually see something in my head and feel it at the same time. And so the song hopefully kind of conveys a hopefulness and a little bit more of a promise for all of us to sort of commit to loving the earth and trying to turn some of this nonsense around, you know?
All right, so very different sound palette for this one. What was the order of production with this, that Jeffrey, again, created the beginnings of it and then...
Much like Rebel Flame, this is something where I created a loop on the piano, that ascending line.
Yep.
So I created that and then I made it into a loop and then I started fitting some aural parts into it and then laid a drum track in and then put the track together. And again, I sent a little bit of it to Mark and he said, I always love it when he says this, send me the stems. So I sent him the stems and Mark took it from there.
So we again have some fairly simple elements. This one was even clearer because it's not, you know, the big dance hall wall of sound that the first one was. This is a ballad, and that you've got your synth string pad that comes in. Now we're taking up space as if, you know, the orchestra, the violins are doing their thing. Then it walks off when you've got the pre-chorus. You have another, is that an actual guitar this time?
Yeah, it is. There's actually two different guitars on it.
Okay. But it's pretty much one chord, right? That's just breathing, yeah. You know, sort of taking up the same space that the strings were taking before. And then the strings take back up. And during this first verse, neither of those things are in there. So you're just hearing the drums and the bass and this subliminal percussion parts. That was one of the most interesting parts of the song. You've got that, and you've got these little lead riffs that come in, these, you know, that, as well as these sort of vocoder sound that sounds very current, some of the noises here.
I actually took some riffs from another song on the album that I had done vocally and brought those in to this as sort of a subliminal callback to some of the other songs. And then I put some vocal synth on it.
Is it just turning auto-tune up to 10?
This one goes to 10.
Yeah, we're not really big fans of that, but the sound of that just sounded so cool. I just, you know, let's just put it in, but it's more like a texture.
Sure, it's a lead guitar riff, basically, that it's a transitional thing.
We're not afraid of using anything that's at our disposal. So although a lot of the reviews we've been getting keep referencing that it's a throwback, that it's very 80s, that these guys do the 80s so well, what they don't realize is we're not doing the 80s well. We were the 80s. We're kind of OG. So we're not actually copying a sound or pimping a sound. We are that sound, but we're not afraid to incorporate the new elements. And I think you rightly observed this is kind of a little bit different of a sonic palette than Rebel Flame, and it sounds a little more current. But what we're aware of with the Rhema sound is it's Mark's voice that ties it all together. The way that he approaches the vocal makes it all sound like Rhema. And even though this ballad is using some vocal synth and it does sound a little more current and it's a little more sparse and it's not the great big dance electronica thing that you mentioned, Mark's voice is a thread through both songs. You know who the vocalist is, you know where he's coming from. And I think that's one of the beautiful parts of the sound of whatever we do.
So even the call and response thing with the chanting and then the singing after the chanting, those are still both Mark? Or is that, I was thinking that you're listed as Jeffrey as singing somewhere on this. Is it just harmonies here and there, or is anything that I could pick out?
One of the songs on the album is called Shine, and my voice is doing all the vocals on the the pre-chorus. But yeah, generally, most of what you hear is going to be Mark's voice. I'll send Mark stems, and there are times when I'll stack vocals. And sometimes Mark keeps them and adds to them. Sometimes he keeps them as is, and sometimes he redoes them.
I'll explain to you a little bit of why I'm such a control freak on that. So,
just on that?
Well, it's great that you guys don't take these things personally, that you've worked together for long enough. Like if you're doing this with a new person and like, yeah, I replaced all your vocals. Is that okay? Like that would be potentially offensive, but no, you get used.
I was alluding to that earlier. And the reason that this works so well for Mark and I is we both can go into our own studios. We can communicate by messenger. And we have the space to breathe and not be in each other's airspace. Because I said to Mark once, you know what? We did our time. We did our time of sweating it out in the rehearsal studio and fighting and going home with your ego bruised. And we've done that. We've been there. We've done our time. We deserve this.
That's the advantage of having been in bands for so long. It's just like, no, let's just get it done. I think we're both about just getting it done and making it as good as it can be and stuff. I'm a composer that does a lot of stuff for movie marketing. So I do trailers and stuff like that. So I've amassed quite a bit of equipment that is able to emulate a lot of different musical styles, which is a blessing and a curse. But I will say that it does allow me to get into a track and find a mood for it really, really quickly. And then you mentioned also some of the bigness of it. I think some of that comes from the fact that I've done a lot of orchestral stuff, done some movie scores and stuff like that. So when I go back to the synthesizer that I kind of cut my teeth on back in the 80s, when I do this stuff, it tends to come out that way. It just kind of tends to be bigger and more massive than I even think it is when I'm working on it. But when it all comes out, it tends to be kind of large. But it's the sound, so we're just doing it. You know, go with what comes naturally.
And you're astute in seeing that one of the elements that makes this work is I admire Mark's vocal abilities and I admire his voice, and there is no competition. So that makes it nice.
Makes it nice for me too.
If I send something to Mark and he changes it, I know what he's changed it to actually made it better. Because again, I even sing like a drummer. And drummers are annoying.
Our egos are in good shape. I think our egos are in a very good check in the way we work with each other. We have a lot of mutual respect. We came up in this a long time ago, and it's a very good place to be in creatively, to have such mutual respect and camaraderie with what we're trying to get done.
Since we're on this, that you're working in different places and you decided to use the old band name, so it certainly wouldn't be difficult if you wanted to like ask one or two of the other guys to participate, you know, give them a chance to do an overdub. But that was obviously just not, you know, this was something that came out of you two working together. I mean, was there any issue with that, or just that band had been broken up for so long, nobody cares who uses the name at this point besides you guys?
I don't believe that there's anyone who cares. Okay. But one of the keyboard player, Craig, we're in touch with him quite a bit. He's always been such a sweet guy and a really good friend and stuff. And he's been nothing but supportive. You know, he's got his own things that he's doing and stuff. And we're going to do another record, and we may have something, you know, a couple of tracks or something that we might want to revisit and see how he might fit in, but definitely not as part of the band, just because we love him very much, but we're kind of cruising with the way things are going right now. It feels good, and we get a lot done this way, and we're having a good time.
And what happened after Rhema broke up and the record deal fell apart because of the movie we were involved with didn't quite manifest? And boy, that's a really unusual story. That doesn't happen in this business much. But anyway, what happened is Mark and I had always been the driving force behind the band. We had always seen eye to eye, and we decided we were going to move to Los Angeles together and be a production and songwriting team. So we got into writing R&B and working with R&B artists and developing artists. So we kind of forged a relationship after the band, and the rest of the band just fell away.
We're kind of the only ones who have kind of stuck with it.
Yeah, nobody else is in the music business, so it's like there's really no reason. As a matter of fact, we are relaunching Rhema as a live act, but it's with some new guys.
Yeah.
Now, stylistically, according to this bio that I can link folks to, written by Craig, that by the time that you got to the material that made in the movie, movies that you guys started, what, 78 or something, 76? When exactly? Sometime in the 70s.
I was in high school, late 70s. And
as a Christian rock band or...
Exactly. A Christian band. We went to a Christian high school, and that's why the name Rhema. If it's been a little off-putting to some people who...
It's off-putting to me.
I'm just throwing it out there. We don't have to, you could look into this. The world is so small. It doesn't actually mention Jesus, but it sure, it's this very positive song. It could
Absolutely.
Be.
I am not a Christian. I don't identify with that at all. My dad was a pastor. I see things quite differently now.
I just threw that out just to echo what was in the bio. So by the time that you get to the 80s, yeah, and it sort of moved through a few different styles and became sort of a prog band for a while. And then the way he describes is that by the time this collection that you had sent me the MP3s of, which is still available online, this whole Voyage of the Rock Aliens album, which is not just not things that were necessarily in the Rock Aliens, I guess it was the name of the collection here, but that was never actually released as an album at the time, right? Like there's no LPs of this?
Not in the States.
Oh, so there is an LP of this in Europe somewhere.
There's a CD and there's a vinyl, and I've gotten them both from imports.
And I had thought that the song that we're going to hear for the third one, we're going to hear a later remix, but the original version of this Combine Man sounded very Devo. And of course, in the movie, you're dressed like Devo, who just means wearing generic space costumes.
A bad Devo.
But then, you know, working my way through that whole collection, like, so Craig describes it as that you're recycling various things from the 80s, that it was kind of taking shots in the dark. And you can definitely hear one of you in some past interview describe Combine Man in particular as being sort of like the She Blinded Me with Science, the Thomas Dolby.
Right.
There's at least one tune that really, it could be Toto, and there's one that has a definite Oingo Boingo vibe. And so it's not all just one thing. And then interestingly, this new stuff, like your first single off this new album, Life in Front of You, we're going to play that at the end of this interview, that sounds 80s in a way, but it doesn't sound like your stuff from the 80s. Like it has some sort of Simple Minds flavor. Like, you know, this kind of part of that is because the video you did for that is all John Hughes montage stuff. So it kind of brings to mind, and I'm even imposing that on the music, that it has those things from the 80s. But So again, like if I bring up Depeche Mode or something, like your stuff from the 80s doesn't sound like Depeche Mode at all that I can see.
What happened there was, Jeffrey mentioned it, and that was that we had this producer, Dennis Alexander, and he owned the studio that we were in, and we had a deal with him, and he had the contact with Curb Records, MCA Records. And so I think with all that in mind, I think he just sort of like decided, I've got this concept and I'm just going to do it. And what it ended up being was, you know, following a lot of things that were already out there. And we were, you know, actively writing on the songs, but we were not able to really get a lot of our ideas in there in the production. But what ended up happening, though, is after the deal and Rhema went on to play locally and we kept recording, really the throwback to that era is where we're picking up from. And that was a little bit more of a refined sound. It was more of its own thing. And, you know, not everything was super, super fast. I don't know why all that early stuff was just so fast.
We were in a hurry to get that part of our career over with.
Over with, yeah. We're not really taking off of the stuff that was in the movie or associated with the movie, because that really wasn't what Rhema ended up being. It was definitely rooted in the 80s, but it was not chasing trends so much.
And to a certain extent, I think the way I feel about it now is we are creating Rhema in the image of what it would have been if Mark and I would have taken control back then and had a lot more say over the direction. It would have been a lot more cohesive.
And also having more equipment than a Geno 60 and a Lynn drum machine helps.
I can hear, you know, in several of the tracks on the new album, I mean, it's definitely still, just like the old album, it's a very varied bunch. Like, it's different. It's not all, if you want to say it's 80s throwback, it's not one style of 80s. It's different.
Nope.
And it's much larger, you know, just the techno dance hall kind of thing. What several of them have, like Rebel Flame, of one sort or another, you know, a big bombastic dance hall drum kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I also hear some R&B in The World Is So Small. Especially like you got these key changes between the verse and the pre-chorus and then the chorus itself. You can't do key changes like that in a big techno song. That's not allowed.
Right.
That screws people on the dance. Maybe you can think of something that is an exception to that, but I've never heard it. Usually you got the groove, you got your long train running groove or whatever it is, and you just got to keep going with it. And it can go for 20 minutes. You can't suddenly go from minor to major and then jump down what it's going from F, where the last chord is E flat, to B minor, like going into that first verse. Can you say a little about those compositional choices?
We both struggled with that, actually, but we didn't want to change it.
We did change it. Jeff, the original thing that Jeffrey had come over, here's the nice thing about Jeffrey. He has an innate sense of musicality that is fearless. And so when he puts the stuff together, sometimes you go, whoa, your head kind of tilts and you go, what? What happened? What? Oh, you know, and then it gives you an idea and then you can spin off of that. You can go with it. But it's been kind of freeing in a way because it's like you get an idea and then it's just something I wouldn't think of. I just wouldn't think of it. And then I just try to tie it all in and I like it. It's one of my favorite tracks on the record. But I think that if you're talking to songwriters, I feel like when you're producing, you're pulling all those stuff together. A lot of times you don't know what you have until you're done. And then you listen to it later and you either go, you know, I kind of like that. Or you go, oh, geez. But at some point, you surrender to it, right? Because if you just sit there and beat it to death with a stick, it just gets stale. And so, like, I think what we try to do is we at least try to keep it fresh and go with it. If it's flowing, if it makes sense, if it moves you, if it feels right, then you're done. You just got to put it to bed. And it's the hardest thing for me to do is to send it to the mastering guy and go, yep, here we go. Because, you know, you could sit and just mess with it forever and it's just, it's futile. It's like you got to let the technology be a tool, but you can't let it run your creative process at all.
And I do think what you're hearing is if you're here Depeche Mode and you say, well, Rhema is basically just doing Depeche Mode. Well, Depeche Mode is very atonal. It's very constant. OMD is very constant because a group like OMD is writing strictly from synths and from synthetic drum grooves. Whereas Mark and I grew up listening to Earth, Wind, and Fire. We grew up listening to R&B. We love pop music. So our writing is not dictated by technology. So when you say, well, I hear things, it's kind of all over the map. That's because we come from a background where you write songs, you write pop songs. And we don't set out to write songs that are specifically that 80s stiff electronica. There were some great songs that came out of Depeche Mode. Come on, their longevity speaks for how good their music and how well they do what they do. But Mark and I, at heart, are songwriters. And you could say, well, write me a pop country song, which Mark and I have both done, and we could do it. You could say, write me an R&B song. Mark and I wrote R&B for a long time. We developed artists, and we were writing R&B songs. So we're songwriters as opposed to an 80s techno band that had two writers that wrote 80s techno songs.
I like that there are these, as well as the key changes, you've got these shifts in vocal persona, I guess, you know, that you're doing the sort of low, simple mindsy thing in the verse here. And then we jump for this, as soon as this pre-chorus hits, or I think you called it the link in your, you know, because it's just two lines just to get us to the chorus. We turn major here, and it's now where I thought it was late 80s, early 90s Chicago song. You know, it's got that pure tenor thing that just rises out.
One of my favorite bands.
Rises out of there. That's actually one of my first, you know, when I was like 12, that was like my favorite band, because I had come out of an orchestral background, and so those David Foster super arrangements really appealed to me. That, like,
you're talking about the David Foster era?
Yeah.
Of Chicago?
Yeah.
Which still has a little of that R&B clinging to it.
Yeah. And by the way, that was David Foster's favorite era of Chicago, too, and he'll gladly tell you that. You mentioned Mark singing, and so I'm going to tell you a little-known fact about Mark that's titillating, and he'll hate that I said this. Mark actually auditioned to be the lead singer of Toto.
Yeah. It's in his bio somewhere. Somewhere I read some interview, so...
It's not very often you put in your bio the gig you didn't get, but it was worth it, because, you know, I got to stand and sing in the open air between Steve Lukather and David Page. And they said, okay, Mark, we're looking for a cross between Steve Winwood, Steve Perry, and Stevie Wonder. No pressure. And so I proceeded to fail singing Rosanna, But it was great. I mean, I'm so glad I did it.
And which guy, was it John Williams' son that got it instead of you at that point?
I don't think so. I think...
There were like four different people in that slot over the years.
Yeah, totally, yeah.
Joe Williams, that one guy that did one album and then they got rid of him. And then the Swedish guy. I think it was the Swedish guy. It was right after the Swedish guy. I think Bobby Kimball came back and Mark didn't get the gig.
I love that band.
What it illustrates is at the time he got the Toto audition, Mark was actually working a lot in the high range of his voice. So you hear him with the Bowie inflections on the Ramus stuff. And The World Is So Small is a great example of that. The verse on The World Is So Small is my favorite vocal on the record of Mark's. And he's in that very deep baritone Bowie-esque sound, but then he goes into that high pharyngeal range of his voice. Well, that's because for a long time, Mark and I were an R&B duo. If you remember the band Go West, we were trying to be like Hall & Oates, Go Westy, that we loved Go West, and we were trying to get signed as an R&B white blue-eyed soul. We had Atlantic Star's manager. Manager was managing us. He was shopping us. And at that time, we were writing songs that Mark had to sing way high. I mean, right at the top of his range. And we gladly wrote them. And I think maybe it annoyed him. But he was working on R&B chops. So that you hear that on the record, that this guy's not just, you know, you can't imagine the lead singer of Depeche Mode ever auditioning to be the lead singer of Toto. It's not going to happen.
Well, thank you.
Let's actually get one of the old songs out there, although we're not. I can play a little bit of the original version, insert that as it seems relevant in the course of our discussion here. But the version that you had picked was the 2009 remix of Combine Man. So this was, right, Mark, you co-wrote this with Craig Jensen. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any of the Dennis, the original producer stuff left?
I used a lot of the original track. It was such, your audience will hear it. The fidelity was so bad anyway. I just took it and just took some frequencies out and twisted it around and did some weird stuff to it. And just, I did it just for fun, actually. But Jeffrey and I weren't even talking about it at the time. So it was just something I did on a whim. I guess it was portents too. Where we are now.
Oh.
So I guess what I like about the Devo-esque original is that it, every little thing stands out, that, you know, the whistling part is very important. And the, when you get into the chorus, it's, there's this da, 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 you know, this two note thing, which is still there in the remix, but it's just, there's enough other stuff going on in the remix. There's like a bigger drums during that part. It's not as stark. In fact, the first time I heard Devo, you know, after being inculcated by David Foster kind of synth, I'm like, there's not enough going on here. Why are they just going chunk, chunk, chunk? But yeah, there's something almost very punk about that sort of stripped down approach to techno. It doesn't disappear in this remix, but it sounds like you had a lot of fun with it in terms of adding the extra goofy stuff.
Can we just say something about the songwriting of that song, the lyric? Jeffrey and Craig both have backgrounds in working in the mental health field. And there was a particular gentleman who both Jeffrey and Craig knew. And he was one of these guys that would repeat these stories. And he was kind of obsessed with, Jeffrey, you probably tell him better than I can, but there were just these phrases that he would continually repeat based on this guy's rants and stuff.
Yeah, his name was Eugene. And Eugene was mentally ill, and he had this great shock of red hair, and he would sit around all day perseverating on themes. And the theme was, he would say,
big old Ernie Ford, big old Ernie Ford, he's a tractor man, he's a combine man, he's a walking man, he's a wooden man.
He would talk and say these things all day long incessantly.
And it was kind of obsessed with Tennessee Ernie Ford for some reason, and 16 tons. And so we you know, Dennis was coming up with this thing. He says, hey, I'm going to do something like Thomas Dolby. All right. So he's working on this track. So three or four of us go in the other room and just start, okay, this track is quirky. Let's just write. I said, Craig, give me every line that you know that Eugene says. Let's just write them out. And then we just took those lines and we just started formulating it into a song. There's not one single lyrical idea that didn't come from out of his mouth. Not even a passing note or a word to get into another sentence. It's all verbatim.
Yeah, we didn't embellish it by trying to add A's and the's and words that would make it proper English. We literally just strung his rants together and fit it into this track.
Which is why the rhyming scheme is a little odd, but it was just so much fun. It was just a great time.
So this is your for the benefit of Mr. Kite, where you find a pre-existing weird text.
Well done. And no slam on Dennis Alexander, but you know, Thomas Dolby to Mark and I is the master of this genre. And this track is no Thomas Dolby.
There's a lot I like about the original. It's one of the more distinctive tunes from that album.
For sure.
And even just the fact that, like I was saying, in terms of the simplicity, like these electronic toms with their definite different pitches, like that becomes a riff.
The Simmons. Like, yeah, I was talking about the original track, not the remix.
Yes.
Because Dennis did think, oh man, I'm gonna do this Thomas Dolby thing. It's going to be great. And then you listen back and you go, no, you listen to Thomas Dolby. I mean, that guy is a genius.
Any thought about the structure of this one? Your hey, 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 hip, hip, and just where things would go. Again, the lyrics are not dictating a structure to you. How are you deciding with this kind of thing, like how long it's going to go? Or do you even remember at the time?
You talking about the original?
Either one.
I don't know. This song, I don't know. We love the song because it's so out there. I just love the song. I'm even thinking of maybe we should do it again in some other way, like a ballad or something.
Because we want to incorporate it into the live show that we're going to do. But I think it's one of those songs that, like the prototype of the song, which would be the person Eugene, which you can't put Eugene into any kind of a box or you can't explain him. Someone who sits around talking about big old Ernie Ford, he's a combine man, he's a tractor man, he's a wooden man, he's a walking man. This song is sort of the same thing. It's hard to explain how it came together. And it's one of those things that was crafted, but it also, there's something about it that's very pure. It's a very pure song, and we don't know how it happened. We really don't.
Yeah, it's really weird.
I think it's what got us signed to MCA, and I think it's what got us in the movie, that song.
Yeah.
I also listened to today to the one of the things on that the Rock Aliens collection, track 22 was the Combine Man solo piano version, which I guess was Craig by himself. You can barely tell it's the same song.
Well, we love Craig, but he and Eugene could have been brothers. Craig was so musically gifted that he sort of teetered in a world that the rest of us don't reside in.
Craig's a genius, honestly. He's pretty amazing. But
well, the remix here at least gives, you know, some sort of bridge between the two eras here, that you've got a disco instrumental section that you insert. It's not that you made things longer, but you, I guess, overdubbed more stuff. It definitely de-emphasizes the whistling part, you know, which is pretty much the only thing that's going on in the original version at the end of the song, is the little whistling part comes in a little more often. But here you've got this whole extra layers of stuff.
That sounds more like Dolby.
Yeah, that was Greg Bond's vocal that I found. I was able to isolate somewhat and then just repeat and pitch it up and do some weird stuff too.
Was that Greg doing the primary vocal on that one as well, or was that you?
That was a group sound.
Yeah,
it was a group sound. It was Craig, and myself. We just sort of barked out the lyrics and the verses and stuff. And then Craig is the guy who kind of did the imitation of Eugene. So you hear that, that sort of spoken thing. That's all Eugene.
But on the verse, you clearly hear Mark's Bowie voice.
Yeah.
And that's where we would have liked the band to have gone, just because of turmoil, we couldn't.
We sort of bent in that direction, I think, after that four-song demo that got the deal. And then we, as we developed as a band, we went more to the sound that you hear now, vocally.
Well, very excited that you finished the full album. Yeah, let's play the last song, The Life in Front of You. Probably the best song in the album. Maybe it's just the one I've listened to the most.
You and I agree, by the way. You and I completely agree. And for the record, this is a total Mark Jackson track. He had this track that he sent it to me, and he said, how do you feel about this for the Rhema album? And I can tell you right now, the first three or four times I heard this song, I was air drumming like a 10-year-old stupid child. I was sitting in my studio air drumming, going, God, I can imagine playing drums on this live. This is such a great track. It's my favorite track on the record for sure.
Well, and after sitting with Rebel Flame and things like that for a while and listening to some of these other songs, and I was focusing more for those on the complexity of the arrangements and the fact that you've got so much going on, and I was thinking that that was different than Life in Front of You. But no, actually, Life in Front of You has just as much of that. It's just that the hook of Life in Front of You is so overwhelming that I just forgot about the rest of the, you know. It's just the whoa.
It's nice that you have an album that has at least one song that... it does that kind of a thing. So that's the goal.
Yeah. Any last words about what the meaning of this song, what you're trying to put over?
Life in Front of You?
Yes.
I think Life in Front of You came about, I was going through a time where my family and I moved up to upstate New York for a while, for a couple of years. And I just missed being in Los Angeles so much that we ended up coming back, and I ended up coming back ahead of the family, and I was parked in a room with no furniture or anything. I just had my recording rig. That's all I had. And I just was inspired by the idea of just this. I had this whole fresh look of Los Angeles. I came back and I just appreciated so many things that you don't get in smaller towns. And that's what brought the song out. That's Life in Front of You. You've got everything, anything you want to do. Just go make it happen. And, you know, there's some little bit more profundity, I think, in the verses in terms of like what the meaning of life is life just winning or losing? You know, it's like, it's more than that. And it's all right in front of you, no matter how old you are or how young you are. It's optimistic. Make it what you want it to be.
And so this is an interesting thing. I get to react now as a listener to one of Mark's tracks. And I'll say that I've known Mark a long time, so I kind of know him on a level a lot of people maybe don't. And as many songwriters and artists, I tend to dwell in the rivers of the cynic. I swim there pretty readily. And I was struck by how optimistic this song was, because I know some of the travails Mark's been through and the dark places he's been in. Personally, I like to stay in the dark places. Sometimes I write better music. But I was just astounded by how positive this track is. And every time I hear the track, it gives me a lift. And I love songs that do that.
Thanks, man.
Well, thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having us, man. It's been a real pleasure.
It's an honor.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks to Mark and Jeffrey. As listeners will know, I generally don't have more than one artist on at a time. I think it would have been a somewhat different conversation if I had just been talking to one of them about their entire musical history, gotten more of a flavor about the various industry things they've done. Mark has released at least one solo album and toured with Donny Osmond, Roger Daltrey, performed on stage with Sheryl Crow, recorded with Richard Marx, been on several TV shows. Jeffrey also writes for film and TV. and was a founding member, songwriter, drummer for the band Clementine. And I see also is currently in something called Bon Jovi Tribute Band. Mark also runs Moon Lab Music, which Jeffrey is also involved with, which, as they described, records music for trailers. So there's lots more we could have talked about. If you look at the blog post for this episode at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com, I will link to some of Mark's videos and their other work, as well as the full version of A Voyage of the Rock Aliens, which is, I will not say good, but it is a remarkable film. Please subscribe to the podcast to hear my upcoming episode with Billy James, i.e. Aunt B, Amy Annell, Aaron David Gleason, Sarah McQuaid, Pratik Kuhad, and I did another little catch-up recording with Craig Wedren about his new album. Please support the podcast. If you would like it to continue, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic. Sign up for a small recurring donation. You can follow us on Facebook. Email me with topic suggestions or feedback on the show at mark@nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.